Well, hello again, everybody, and once more into the trees, people and built environment four we go. This week we're going to be interviewing Professor Ian Bateman. Sharon, over to you.
I've never interviewed an economist before.
I know, economist. I mean, how do we get into this field? This is a completely different stratosphere, isn't it?
It was a bit daunting, but he was so much fun.
Well, I have to say, if an economist is a lot of fun, I want to hear it. So let's get over to it. Hold on a second.
Welcome to Professor Ian Bateman, OBE. We're so pleased to have you join us today. Ian, you've got a really long job title. Here we go. Professor of Environmental Economics and Director of the Land, Environment, Economics and Policy Institute, University of Exeter Business School. Phew!
Well done. That's great. I'm so glad I didn't have to say that.
Tell us about your interest in the natural world and how it all started.
When I was a kid, a lot of it is, and I think this is true for many of us, it's right down to those early formative years. And although I was born right in the middle of Birmingham, an area called Handsworth, very, very urban, my dad was a carpenter and was really passionate about the natural world. Every school holiday, most weekends, and 6 to 8 weeks in summer, it was fantastic. We would just bunk off and we would go down to places like the Lizard in Cornwall and Mid Wales and that sort of stuff. And he did infuse me and both my sisters with this love of the natural environment. And we always hated going back. It's that love of the environment that guided me into that. When I was, you know, doing A-levels, well, I never thought I'd go to university because I didn't know anybody that went to university. Nobody in my family, nobody in my street, nobody in my school virtually. I was passionate about the environment, but to be honest, I didn't think I'd get a job in it.
Yeah, I can really relate to that because when I went to a very, very average comprehensive and was the first in my family to go to university, at that time, people didn't understand what jobs were available or would be available. And equally, we don't know now what will be available in 20 years' time. You went to university and where did you go after there?
I mean, we had such huge unemployment there, massive. And so I thought, well, there's no point me going into, you know, the stuff I love, to be honest. So I'm going to go and do economics. And I'll do economics because I was quite good at it. And also I just thought I'm always going to get a job. All right. So that's actually what I did. And I did my first degree in it. And economics has been good to me, but there's a lot of it that's incredibly boring. It's exactly what you think it's going to be. And it teaches you some great skills. I did have this second interest in life, which was humans. And it tells you an awful lot about humans. And it's not anywhere as dismal as people think it is. But all the jobs that people offer you are just so tedious. It was while I was doing my master's and a bit of a sort of epiphany moment. I went into the office of this guy that I really admired, a guy called Noel. And I said, I'd like you to supervise my master's thesis. And he said, yeah, happy to do that. What are you interested in? And I said, well, it's irrelevant because what I'm interested in is trees, you know, so that's no good. It's an economics department, you know. Might as well say I'm interested in icing sugar. And he said, no, honestly, I think we can do a thesis on trees. That's all right. And that's where it started. I started unmarried. I ended 8 years later with three kids and a wife and a house. I suppose I kind of improvised as I went along and I did more and more on what I was interested in, which was trees. In a way, that's really what I've been doing ever since. The absolutely wonderful thing about trees is that they are so complex and they generate so many different positive and negative effects when you plant a tree, generally more positives than negatives, but we have to recognize the negatives as well, otherwise it can't be fair. you can easily spend an entire lifetime looking at trees. I was also interested in other land uses. So it's really trees and agriculture together that are two that have really fascinated me right the way through. And the fact that there's humans involved in at every stage.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I love trees. That's the most ridiculous thing I could say. But it's really the interrelation between science, mathematics, humans, how people live, their mental health, their physical health, how it interacts with every single aspect of art and science. It is a fantastic career. And you've actually been around the world, haven't you? You've worked in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah. I've spent a fair time in New Zealand. Such a wonderful country. Lovely people. Also, you know, spent a fair time in the USA. Spent time in the sequoias and met bristlecone pines.
Wow. How wonderful. How wonderful. And in your current role, being a director of these three things, land, environment, economics, tell us about the interrelation between the human capital, the manufacture capital, and the financial capital.
I actually
and how
think
the natural
you can,
world fits into
you
that.
You can understand at a high level the interaction between the natural environment, the economy, and people by thinking of it in this way. So, what is this idea of capital? It's a very value laden word, but really, all we're talking about with capital is something, some entity that has the ability to provide a service to humans which is beneficial. And you can think about that in terms of a machine. You know, that's how we normally think about capital, some machine. And of itself, it is of no value whatsoever. It's just a lump of metal or something, but it can produce services that can make our life a lot easier. That's really the principle that we use when we're looking at the natural environment as well. And this might sound a bit mechanistic, but actually, when you think it through, it's a way of really bringing the natural environment into our decisions rather than pretending that our decisions are separate from the environment, because they're not. There's a two-way flow. If you think about things like the natural environment in terms of soils and water and atmosphere and living things, what do they have in common? Well, one of the things is that if we shepherd them and husband them correctly, they can provide us with services and improve our lives and well-being sustainably, genuinely sustainably, forever. That's the great thing about nature's capital. All the other types of capital, we have to invest in them to make them grow. Here's a source of potentially unending support and services for our well-being. The only thing that we have to do is not mess it up. So this is something I'm really very interested in and also a bit passionate about. So let's just think about the complexity of real-world decision-making. Let's make you, okay, Sharon, I'm going to make you queen of the world, all right? And you are in charge of everything.
People are laughing all over the world right now, so she already thinks she is.
Is that right? Right. Well, I'm just telling them what the reality of life already is. So what you say goes, all right? And I'm going to add one other thing here. I'm going to assume you're a nice queen, all right?
Oh, I'm lovely.
You seem it, absolutely. And what's more, you want what's best for everybody. Now, how are you going to do it? You've got to look at all those different types of capital. You've got to bring them all together. You've got to make this incredible set of goods that determine our well-being, all right? So you've got limited resources, huge, unlimited list of wants, okay? What are you going to do? You can't just say yes to everything. That's not allowed. So I think what you're going to do is you're going to say, I need a bit of information here.
I was going to say what I would do if I was queen of the world, apart from getting a really nice throne, probably sort of pink velvet, is I would listen and research. I would listen to what people think And that's really what the basis of any study is. It's listening and looking and analysing.
I really like the fact that you're thinking about these things together, and to people in our industry, by that I mean land-based industries, there has been historically a big disconnect between how one would conventionally think of economics and manufacturing and the environment. You know, the environment was not considered. We know now that it is being considered, albeit rather lately, and at a rapidly increasing pace to meet global targets for carbon offsetting. And equally, I think it's a really exciting time because the ways of measuring the natural environment have improved so much. So have you observed in the last, say, 10 years, a really fantastic, exciting time of how we quantify different aspects of the natural world? And do you find that useful in your work?
Yes, absolutely. It has been incredible. It is important to try and measure these things. Why is it? Why can't we just, you know, do the right thing? Well, the problem is that we have a set of wants which unfortunately is greater than the resources available to satisfy them. We have a finite world. And because of those resource constraints, every time we do one thing, that must mean that we cannot do some other thing because we don't have infinite resources. There is always a cost to doing something. And if you ignore that, then you're not making decisions fairly. You're ignoring a cost either on other people now that could be benefiting from other actions, or, and this is very common, people in the future. If you take something like fish stocks, so you can think of that as a form of natural capital. You've got the population of fish in the world, and every year it generates a new set of fish. And we can harvest that sustainably as long as we make sure that the capital stock, the whole population, stays the same. And we can keep doing this forever. But if we over-harvest it, we're actually making a decision, typically blindly, that we in this generation now are more important than people in the future. And we are reducing that stock in ways which can actually be difficult to predict, can result in what's called tipping points, where suddenly the stock collapses. And we're seeing this, you know, there's a real worry that this will happen with the climate and how we're treating that. And these are just facts of physics, really. You can't ignore them in the end. And if you don't bring this information in, you will be making decisions that are truly non-sustainable.
I totally agree. And I think, obviously, we know in the past, many decisions have been blindly made, some willfully made, to reach that tipping point. And there is such a groundswell of public opinion and government promises. I feel that with arboriculture and forestry, there's been tremendous strides, as I say, in quantifying what we have at sort of huge scale, remote sensing, looking at the health of forests, at a slightly smaller scale, looking at the ecosystem services that tree populations have, using something like iTree, with ecology, looking at the biodiversity, net gains, metrics. So there is a lot more quantification. And I've noticed in my own work that putting numbers to things, the numbers of how the carbon sequestration of a site will change, what the economic value of those trees are, it actually is waking up the mindset of those who wouldn't ordinarily be engaged with the natural world. People, through their training and their background, not necessarily willfully, but it's not in their culture to consider how to quantify the natural world. But fortunately, there are plenty of people who know how to do it or are learning, and we're developing new ways. And so I wondered, in your career in the last 10 years, if you actually feel more positive because of increasing science, or more negative?
I actually feel more positive about addressing climate change than I have done for quite a long time. Particularly, you know, strides that are being made in reducing emissions at the power generation stage. I think it's getting to the point where it will be cheaper to use renewables than fossil fuels. And that will change absolutely everything. You know, we could very usefully bring that point a bit closer, for example, by putting some taxes on fossil fuels, a beginning of a recognition of the cost that they are imposing on the rest of the world and future generations. That would help tip things sooner. So I'd be all in favour of that. So I do feel more positive about that. I don't feel more positive about the world's biodiversity. We have an issue that we still are in this strange mindset that biodiversity is something that just happens elsewhere, and it's nothing to do with us. And the fact that we just bought this mahogany table, or that we are drinking our cocoa and frying with palm oil and that sort of stuff, and it's everything to do with us. We are a long, long way from institutions which will actually make it in a firm's best interest to protect biodiversity as opposed to degrade it. So I'm not a person who thinks that we should rely solely on polemic and sort of arguing that firms should do better. There's a real good place for that. But first of all, that's not me. I've got this other set of hopefully skills and working with firms to sort of say, look, if you actually change your operations like this, not only will you not be sending this species to the edge of extinction, but actually you'll be saving yourself some money. That has a big impact.
It's rather like me saying to a developer, look, I know you think you want to get rid of these big trees at the front of the site, but actually, your houses will be worth more money because they'll be different. They'll be much more attractive. It's making the economic case, which I think where your work is so important, because it cuts across the greenwash language and people like me hugging trees. You're getting to the core. You're speaking the language of people who have a lot of power.
It's a very, very important part of the societal response to the situation we're in. But what worries me is when that's the only response we've got. Because some of those people can do something about what they're doing. But, you know, so for example, I work a lot with the farming community. And farming community gets a lot of flack for what they do. But 99% of the farmers that I work with are not incredibly rich. They have second-hand cars that don't work very well. They have kids that need to, loads of things to go to school with. They haven't been on holiday for the last 5 years. To then say to them, oh, you need to cut your income by 20% so that the amount of nutrients in the estuary go down. It just beggars belief that we don't understand often the situations that people are in. I know very, very few farmers that actually want to farm in an unsustainable way. But we have set up the economic incentives such that it's the only option they've got unless they want to go bust. There is some light on the horizon there. But certainly for a long time, farmers have just not had much choice.
What are your thoughts on how economically it might work for the farming community to put something to create a more biodiverse farm? You know, do you have any thoughts on how you could make a change that would work for the well-being of those who are just scraping a living? As you say, many of our small farmers and dairy farmers, they're just scraping by.
We have been working for years on modelling farmers' decision-making, and it's one of the most complex models we've ever had to come up with. And that's a reflection of the fact that farmers are actually making incredibly complex decisions. You know, they've got a farm which is not homogenous. It's all over the place. You know, one thing is slopy or it's flat and it's, you know, it's got dips and that sort of stuff. Then it might be different soils, different farms, different temperatures, different precipitations, all this sort of stuff. And then they've got to deal with making a decision now about a product that's going to turn up in, you know, 6 months' time based on information about prices and costs that is probably historic. What an incredibly difficult thing to do. And this isn't a minor thing. This is going to determine whether you're viable next year or go bust.
I really saw that firsthand when I lived on the wheat farm. It just completely dependent on the weather. You can chuck a load of science and money at it, but at the end of the day, you have the mercy of the elements and the mercy of machines breaking down, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's complicated.
There are certain circumstances where farming in a more, if you like, biodiverse way is actually a economically sensible thing to do. But there are these huge uncertainties. If you just stick to the tried and trusted, unfortunately unsustainable measures, you're reducing your risk quite considerably. And when it is literally financial life or death, then that's the one you have to go with. But one of the things that government could very helpfully do is de-risk farming from undertaking more environmentally sensitive approaches to land.
Hello, this is Tree Lady Talks, and I'm Sharon Durdant-Hollenby. All music and production is by Noel Durdant-Hollenby, and all views expressed by me or the interviewees are entirely personal.
I'm going to talk about something else. So I'm actually reading a book at the moment because I'm doing a fireside chat for Trees, People and the Built Environment with an author called Richard Louvre, who writes about our wild calling, and it's talking about loss of connection with animals and how important it is to reconnect. One of the things he talks about, which I think chimes with what we're talking about today directly, he talks about the habitat of the heart. All this evidence that you're gathering to present a case to make a change which is economically sustainable, that because ultimately it's probably economically sustainable because it's environmentally sustainable, and to make that change you've got to change people's hearts with facts as well.
I think there's an analogy there between what you're saying there and what I was saying about the biodiversity challenge and making it sustainable. Most of the companies that I work with, they don't want to destroy biodiversity. And farmers don't want to do things that are unsustainable for their land. But there's an economic system which has made it very difficult for them to do anything else. That is the way that at the moment we've organised our economy. And yes, we do need to change it. But I would say that what you need to do as Queen or Empress Sharon of the entire galactic order, what you're going to need, and I think that's what you were in effect saying when you're saying it, I'm going to listen, is you need information. I actually think it's extremely difficult to deal with information without understanding how different options, different use of our limited resources trade off against each other. For example, if you listen to someone and they say, right, all that matters is having a good health service. Well, you know what's going to happen. We're going to have shiny hospitals and no roads or transport to actually get the patients there. Trade-offs are a lot easier to understand in terms of numeric information rather than qualitative, you know, because you end up with people just saying, no, what I think is really important. And just, well, what do I do with really important? Is that more important than very, very important, which this person over there said was their thing? So numbers, I think, really help. And the final thing, which you might disagree with me on that, and that's fair enough, is it's a lot easier to deal with numbers when they're in the same unit. So if I said to you, okay, you know, how many tons of carbon trade against a number of visits to the woodland, trade against tons of timber, trade against the change in flooding risk associated with planting trees, you can't answer that when you're looking at those natural units. So you try and put them into a common unit. I think money is the best unit. Why? Money is a unit of value, which is what we're trying to get at. We're trying to get at how much you're going to improve people's lives by this. So at least it is a unit of value, whereas sort of, you know, trying to put everything in calories or something or joules of energy, that doesn't work. The other big advantage is that, especially when you're looking at something like protection and enhancement of the natural environment, the budgets that governments set up for that are set in a process which broadly, you know, there's a lot of horse trading, but broadly sets out the budget for everything. It sets out the budget for the environment, for education, for health, for security, all of those things. And all those other things are accounted for in money terms, even health. So they'll put a value on how much should we spend to save somebody's life, because it can't be cut, because otherwise we just save one person's life, you know. All of those other things are in money. And then environment often is presented in 50 different units or 1,000 different units. And if you're Queen Sharon and you're trying to do the right thing and everything else is in one unit, you can make that commensurate quite easily. But if all this environment stuff is in 50 different units, how on earth do you work out how much of your limited resource to put onto the environment?
Wow, I just want to pause there because I think that makes so much sense. Because I really love that, because as land-based environmental industries, we're often decrying the fact that people aren't really listening, that it is all a bit woolly and, you know, and we do need habitats of the heart. But actually, it's really interesting the way that arboriculture is going and forestry in measuring financially. The fact that the iTree ecosystem services actually leads to a financial value of different elements of the services that trees provide, how much saving is made on surface water runoff. And that when I'm talking those numbers, the monetary value, then the decision makers and clients sit up. So I really agree with you. So now I feel that we need to work to sort of put values on everything. But I can see everybody debating ad infinitum, really. Oh, how can you value a meadow? How can you value a songbird's song, you know, a nightingale song? And that's a problem, isn't it? Well, it's not a problem. It's a situation.
You can say quite rightly, well, actually, what is the value of a trip to a woodland, you know, the recreational park or something like that? We basically look at what people give up for that trip, and partly it's money, partly it's time, partly it's opportunities to do other things, and they give them up, and all of those things can be valued imperfectly, but an awful lot better than not doing it. There is one element, and I've actually written a paper on this if you're interested. There is one thing that I don't think at the moment we can put a value on, but I do think we can bring it into economic decision-making. So bear with me on this. And that element is actually biodiversity, and particularly the continued existence of species. So you can say, what is the value of biodiversity? Some of it you can value reasonably well. So, you know, there's been a lot of work looking at pollination services and that sort of stuff. And actually the big problem there is not the economics, because we know how much a ton of wheat is worth or something like that. The big problem is that, unfortunately, the biology is not particularly well understood. And that might be a bit of a surprise, because...
Yeah, that's maybe raised my eyebrows.
Surely, you know, I was in second year high school and they told me how a bee pollinates a flower. Yes, we know that. The problem is, suppose that bee dies, okay? Does that mean the flower doesn't get pollinated? Not necessarily at all, because there might be a fly just behind it, which is also a pollinating fly. That's the problem. That's the science problem that's not very well known from that. But nevertheless, we can produce defensible estimates of that. We can also produce defensible estimates of, for example, the value that people get from going bird watching and, you know, recreation that's specific to wildlife, and we can see that. The thing that is difficult is that, and to personalise it, I'm sitting on the sofa and I'm sitting there thinking, God, I really love the fact that there's still polar bears in the world. That's great. I value that. Me as an economist, now sitting outside myself looking at me, there is nothing in my behaviour or spending patterns or how I allocate my time that reflects that. Nothing, you know. Okay, actually, I'm a bit weird because I'm a supporter of Greenpeace, but, you know, most people aren't, okay? And therefore, how do I get any information on that to base a value? And I actually think at the moment we don't have reliable methods to do that. I am quite bullish about it. I think we can value sufficiently well to improve decision-making almost everything, but not biodiversity. So what do we do? Well, the traditional approach is you ignore it. And that's exactly why we've got so many species on the edge of extinction. And my approach is to completely reject that. Say, no. We know there is a value there. We don't know what it is, but we know there is one. And what's more, we have an inkling. It's probably pretty big. And so what can we do? Well, one thing we can do is we can look at measures of people's preference for the existence of animals based on surveys, based on the fact that some of them do join Greenpeace, that sort of stuff, but also their elected representatives have signed agreements that say we're not going to allow this to happen. They haven't kept them very well, so let's enforce them. Let's add to every single decision that we make from now on the absolute guarantee that it will not further degrade biodiversity. That is a way of bringing biodiversity into economic decisions, because what you're saying is, okay, there's five options here. Two of them make things worse for biodiversity, so they're off the table now. Don't care what they're worth, we're not doing those. Now we'll look at the three that aren't going to make things worse for biodiversity. What you find is things that aren't going to make things worse for biodiversity typically actually have a beneficial effect on biodiversity. You could put in stronger requirements. You could say every project from now on has to give a net gain for biodiversity.
And that's what's ideally going to be happening in the development industry, biodiversity net gain. But I wonder also about people's purchasing power. For example, the growth of the organic food market. Many people make choices to buy only organic food or fair trade products, which is obviously a much bigger picture, but inherently entwined is fair trade and how people are treated in areas. And so those products often have a premium price. So those who can afford it and want to make the choice can buy them. But there are many people who can't afford it and so have no choice other than to survive by buying cheap palm oil. You know, we know how harmful that is. If it's left to the free market, then there's forever going to be this mass purchasing power of things at harm, simply because people have to live. What can we do about that? That's a massive question.
I think you basically just asked me to solve every problem in the planet. I'm going to do it in bits. So the first thing you asked me about was how I would put it. In fact, there's a link over the whole thing. I have just been talking for the last few minutes about sort of like a very economic perspective on the challenge that we've got, right? And trying to make sure that all the positives and negatives of each option are included in the decision. If we did that, if we just did that, it'd be a huge improvement in decision making, because one of the big problems is we just don't consider all the benefits and all the costs that are associated with that. And when I say benefits and costs, I'm not just talking about stuff that has pound signs, that is traded through markets. You know, so better water quality in our rivers, there might not be, you can't go into Sainsbury's and buy better water quality in rivers. But that doesn't mean it's not a genuine benefit. Okay. This is the difference between economics and, say, accountancy. I'm not having a go at accountants, but accountancy, that's all to do with what's happening in the market. Market prices, market costs, that sort of stuff. True economics is about that plus all the other influences upon well-being. Okay, all those things that happen outside markets. That's why economists, true economists, are the white knights of the academic world.
No, but I hadn't thought about economics like that. It's fascinating.
That's the real difference. You see, nearly everybody uses the word economics wrong. They use economics when they're thinking about accountancy. And that is not what economics is about. Economics is about all of the influences, positive and negative, upon human well-being. So one thing I want to stress then, and I think it comes out of both the organic side of what you're asking and the poverty side, is that even within this expanded version of economics that we're talking about, I'm still talking about something that often would feel to people as quite a scientific, maybe almost clinical way of looking at things. But one of the things that economics says is that what it's interested in is people's, the word they use is preferences, people's feelings about things, because your feelings drive your value. Okay? So if you've got a feeling about wanting to promote, say, organic production, that sort of stuff, and you follow it up with your behaviour, that's as real as anything else. You know, so that should not be ignored. Similarly, if you've got deep-held ethical beliefs about the way that we distribute the benefits and costs in this world, which I'm sure we both agree on very much, is not equitable at all, then make sure they're reflected in your behaviour. You know, make sure that you do invest ethically, that you do buy products that actually uphold those values, but also campaign. You know, actually say, this is something that I am not happy to support. Vote on that. You know, it's the way to turn those preferences into something that actually affects reality. To answer the biggest question ever, but anyway.
Wow, thank you for that. That's amazing. So how, you work at the University of Exeter, somewhere I know quite well, for many conferences to do with trees. But how can all these fantastic ideas, how can working in academia have a real impact on society?
Yeah, I think it really can. And I think it's actually beholden upon an academic who ultimately is getting public money to actually try and contribute to changing the real world. And yes, partly that's in terms of education. But what we have tried to do is actually effect real change, because that's what I mean by impact. Real impact is when you work with communities or businesses or policymakers and help them to actually put in place changes that will result in a higher level of well-being for society as a whole. So, for example, working with the business, I'll give you an example. We're working with shellfishery businesses around the southwest coast. Shellfishery is really interesting because we've got an industry there that is incredibly low impact on the environment. Basically, you throw ropes over the side of a trawler, and you allow mussels to grow in it, and after a year or two you go back, you pull the ropes up, clean them off, and there you go, and you've got a form of food which has incredibly high protein, really good nutrients. You haven't had to put any fertilizers in at all, there's very, very little in the way of greenhouse gas emissions associated with that. And you've got fabulous food coming. And it's, you know, what we're trying to move on with now is actually work not just with that industry, but also the farmers who need to carry on generating incomes for their families, but trying to do it in ways which won't result in pollution loads into the rivers and into the estuaries and directly affecting those shell fisheries, and trying to work with policymakers to actually effect that change by changing the way that subsidies are applied. Subsidise ways of working which are actually going to leave the land better for the next generation rather than worse. And that includes all of the connections of the land to the rest of the environment.
Wow, that was so interesting. I'm so pleased to see you're an advisor with DEFRA and the Treasury. Finally, Ian, why are you involved with Trees, People and the Built Environment for?
I'm going to end up by giving you my answer from the heart. And that is that I am utterly passionate about trees. While there are places that don't benefit from trees, generally, the best thing you can do with a bit of land is grow a tree on it. Absolutely fantastic. You know, the benefits for you, for other generations, and for the natural environment are just huge. Stick the tree in the right place, you'll be helping the present and helping the future.
Wow, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really looking forward to hearing you as a keynote speaker at the conference. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, I knew I'd be able to get it in, ladies and gentlemen, the Queen of the World. In fact, it's almost like a Star Wars thing, I think, is going on there. he made it fun. I tell you, he made it fun, didn't he?
That was utterly hilarious. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing him give his keynote speech at Trees, People and the Built Environment 4, which is next week.
Yeah, that's right. February the 3rd, February the 4th, Trees, People, Built Environment 4. Make sure you book your ticket if you haven't already. Sharon, who have we got next week?
We're speaking to Amelia Williams. Amelia is an arboricultural consultant, and also she's an expert on bonsai trees.
Bonsai tree? Oh, I like bonsai trees. Tiny, but huge in character.
Absolutely. And there's some correlations, really, between looking after normal, full-grown trees and bonsai trees. And I also want to speak to Amelia about her thoughts on ash dieback, because she's carried out a lot of work on surveying trees of ash dieback disease. So I'm really looking forward to Amelia. She's got so much experience as a consultant and a tree officer and bonsai extraordinaire.
Fabulous. More ladies in Arb. Love it. Can't wait for that. So don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. And you can catch us on Facebook.
Sharon Hosegood Associates.
And Instagram.
Tree Lady Talks.
And Twitter.
At the Tree Lady 67. But before we go, I just want to say hello to all of our listeners in Slovakia.
Oh, yeah. No, good point. Good point. With the charts came out this week. In at 5.
In Slovakia, in nature.
Straight in at 17 in the UK.
In nature podcasts.
Found those stats on the internet, so they must be true. No, it's been another marvellous episode, and it took us by surprise, I've got to be honest. And so, great, well done. Thank you very much, Ian. A lot of fun. And I also like the spaniel barking, which, of course, you won't hear on this edit, but that was a lot of fun. And it could have gone with the retriever barking that we did have at this end as well. So until next time, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from
him.
Okay, triangle.